me just a second here. If I don't clean this off, I'll start reading it. Still have a keen alcoholic mind. My name's Chuck Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Thanks to God, AA, and good sponsorship, I've been sober since December 16th, 1988. I wish I was more like Palmer. It must be an Al-Anon thing. He had a list of names of people to thank, and I don't have a list. All of y'all that go into planning a conference of this size and this success know who you are, and you've all played a huge role in my being here and being comfortable and being thoughtfully overfed all week long. I can't thank you enough for inviting me back. I was originally supposed to be here last year, and well, my parts warranty has run out, and I've had a lot of surgeries, and I couldn't come last year, so thank you for having me back. I'll get going here in a second, and till then, just bear with me. The speakers this week have just been fantastic. I don't know why y'all saved me for Thursday, but you did. I come from a nice house, normal people. Neither one of my parents drank. They didn't need to drink. No one on my dad's whole side of his family drinks, and they would not find it any great deal that I haven't had a drink in 22 years. I've got an aunt that hasn't had a drink in 81 years. My mother's side, however, really rings the bell, and I don't know how Mom escaped it, but she did. And you know, I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but I was certainly born with a resentment, that's for sure. I was all nice and warm inside the womb for 9 months, and all of my needs were met, and when I was hungry, I was fed, and when I was tired, I slept, and then all of a sudden, the eviction came, and, you know, I'm getting thrown out of my nice, warm place, and this guy grabs me, slaps me, and cuts me all in one fluid motion. And I'm kind of mad from then on. Didn't get any better when they sent me to school. I'm the only kid I know that got suspended from kindergarten. I think I needed a sponsor. You know, just somebody you could call up and say, you know, oh, for God's sakes, Chuck, just eat the cookie, drink the milk, and take the nap. And, you know, it'd be okay from there. But I didn't have a sponsor. I probably needed a drink. But I managed to white knuckle it till I was 12. My dad was a personnel manager of a large factory in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I grew up. And every year, if he did a good job, or maybe even at Christmas and a couple times a year, they'd give him a bottle of liquor for doing a fine job. Wish they'd have gave him a bonus check. I could have used that later on. But they gave him liquor, and he didn't drink. Mom didn't drink, but all of her brothers and sisters did. So Dad hid it down in the basement so they wouldn't find it and drink it. I don't know what he was saving it for. They didn't drink, but he put it down there. And like any good alcoholic in the making, I found where he was hiding things early on. And when I'd white-knuckled it as long as I could, and I was 12, I went down and stole a bottle. It was a nice, pretty cut glass bottle, and I stole that and went in and got a couple of my buddies. And we went out in the woods, which would, you know, seemed to be the rest of my life, really, out in the woods. But I grabbed this bottle and a couple of buddies, and we went out there, and I took a big drink and they took a big drink, came back to me, and I'd seen those Bogarts had drank about half, so I drank the rest of it straight down. And probably should have just came to Alcoholics Anonymous the next day. My life never really did get any better. Nothing ever changed. I admire alcoholics that can go to school and go to college and get married and raise children and all that. I didn't do any of that. I had stolen what I'd stolen with a fifth of Seagram's Extra Dry Gin. It was terrible stuff. But it came in a pretty bottle, and that's all I knew about drinking. So I drank that, and me and my buddies went out, and what happened that night happened to me a lot. You know, I drank as much as I could for as long as I could, and that stuff hit bottom and curled my toes and came back up and curled my hair, and I felt like I belonged in my own skin, you know, at last. You know, for 12 years I just, I was a stranger in a strange land, and that liquor made me feel like I belonged. And we went around and we talked to pretty girls and I told some jokes, and you know, then a little while later that liquor had its way with me and I started telling not so nice jokes about my buddies and their moms, and went into a blackout and they beat the hell out of me and took me home, set me on my front porch, rang the doorbell and ran off into the night like the cowards that they were. My parents came downstairs and found their oldest son passed out in a heap on the front porch, and they drugged me into the living room and left me lay there, and they went back to bed. Sometime during the night, one of my brothers snuck downstairs and threw up on me. That's how I remember it. And that was June of 1968, and I grew up in a inner city, went to an inner city high school, about 5,000 students, about 80% black. There were a lot of riots going on, and nobody missed a little seventh grader that wasn't coming to class. You know, the high school I went to, if you made good grades, they noticed you. And if you acted out in class, they noticed you. And if you didn't do anything in school, or like me, didn't come, they just passed you on. And I had that basement full of liquor to drink, and I had a lot of friends because of that. I was kind of big for my age. By the time I was 15, I talked somebody into getting me a fake draft card, and I got that, and went to a bar where they don't check fake draft cards too close, and started bar drinking. My parents had rules that they expected us to follow, like, if you want clean clothes, take your dirty ones to the basement so they can get washed and folded, and then bring them back up. Take the garbage cans to the curb and bring them back. Tough stuff like that. So I just left. That bar that I like to drink in, bartender was working one morning, and a guy came in and was trying to rob him. And I didn't want the police called to that bar because, like I said, that draft card wasn't any too good. So I beat the guy up and took him outside, suggested that wasn't a place for him to go anymore. Went back in, and the bartender was very grateful and turned out to be the owner of the bar, and let me sleep in a back room back there because parents was too hard to live with. And gave me a little job cleaning his bar up. And then for any of you older guys that know what I'm going to say next, I had arrived because he gave me a bar tab. Yeah, that's like a no-interest credit card to y'all that don't know what a bar tab is. And as long as you paid it every Friday, you were good to go. And that thing got paid before anything. And that's where I learned how to live, more or less, fighting and bar games and That's how I learned how to date. You know, my buddies would take their girlfriends to the movies, and I'd take them to Lonnie's Lounge and get them a double shot of Jack Daniels. Young women are easier to work with when they have double shots of Jack Daniels. And like Beth said last on Monday, if they were there on Sunday, it was a relationship. That's how I dated till I got to AA, and you people straightened me out. And that's how I lived. You know? If I wasn't in the back room of that bar, I was in the woods. And I picked up whatever kind of work 15-year-old and 16-year-old kids can pick up. I worked with men, I drank with men, I talked like men that drank at Lonnie's Lounge, anyway. And that went on until I turned 18. My father gave me a job in that factory. And I went to work in that factory. I don't know about you guys, but the only thing worse than bad luck for me is good luck. And he gave me a job making good money, and I went out and got a little place and got a car and decided that I hadn't met all of you guys yet, so I better get busy doing that, and I start driving around, drinking. And I wrecked that car and got a DUI and stood in front of a judge who suggested, since it was an election year, he was going to make an example out of me and suggested that I could do a year in prison or join the Army. And I said, well, let me have a couple days to think about that. And I need to go down to the bar and talk to the old timers. They were probably about 30. And see, because in my neighborhood, kids at that time were doing one of two things. In my neighborhood, they were either going to the penitentiary or they were going to Vietnam. And every kid in my neighborhood that went to the penitentiary came home. And that was not true of kids that went to Vietnam. So I took a few days and I talked to the old timers and they said, Chuck, you should join the Army. And I said, why? And they said, well, they're not sending that many more guys to Vietnam anymore. And guys like that drink like you shouldn't go to the penitentiary. And besides that, if you join the Army, they'll pay you to drink. That sounded like a good idea to me. So. You know, I raised my hand and did my patriotic duty. They sent me to Germany to help the guys coming home from Vietnam acclimate to civilian conditions again before unleashing them back on the United States. So I'd love to stand up here and regale you all with some military stories. I work for the county that I live in as a veteran service officer today. I help veterans apply for their benefits. And man, those cats got some really good war stories to tell. I'm a blackout drinker. They sent me to the best beer capital of the world. And Germany's got good beer, and their bars are just like American bars. And that's about it. One poor guy's job was to make sure that I got up to do my job. I got home about three steps ahead of a bad discharge and went back to work in that factory, and I'll be doggone. The housing industry had boomed in a couple of years I'd been gone, and now I was making twice what I was making before. So I got a little apartment of a brand new Corvette. Which is what every 20-year-old alcoholic should have. And I start driving that thing around town and taking the T-tops off in the middle of winter. And, you know, I got my beach garb on and a half gallon of Jack Daniels between my legs. And the T-tops are off and I'm hooting and hollering. It's 10 below zero. And I'm wondering why I keep getting pulled over for DUI. So, it didn't take my keen alcoholic mind to realize that Cincinnati was my problem. I needed to go somewhere warm like California. So I went there. I missed the sign. And I went to California three different times. we took three different routes when we went. I went with three different groups of guys. And it takes a willpower to be an alcoholic. It really does. They say we don't have any. I tell them, come with me to California a couple of times. Every time I went to California, there I was. Me and my sixth grade education. And Dad was only a personnel director in Cincinnati, so I wasn't living real good. And I'd come home with my tail between my legs, and they'd clean me up and give me a job, and I'd get a little car, get a little apartment, and get a little DUI, and various and sundry other charges. And that's how I lived. One day, my mother came to me and said, Chuck, you know, your father's been ill and he's going to take an early retirement. And it's always been his desire to live in Florida, so we're going to retire to Florida. And I said, that's great, Mom. You guys should go down there and retire and just soak up the sun and enjoy yourself. She said, yeah, baby, I want you to promise me one thing before we leave. And I said, sure, Mom, what can I do for you? She said, Chuck, honey, don't ever come to Florida. So I said, okay, and off they went to enjoy the rest of their lives together in Florida. And the following spring, it was a beautiful day, kind of like what we had here today. It didn't have to be a beautiful day, but it was. I got in the car and started drinking and went into a blackout. When I came out of that blackout, I was surrounded by police. Well, that wasn't unusual. It was unusual, the amount of police, but there were a lot of police present. And it seems that in this drunken blackout, I'd driven my car into the back of a Mercedes-Benz. And that Mercedes-Benz was a graduation present that the local police captain had just bought for his daughter. And, you know, that's like a cop magnet when you do something like that. So all these cops are around, and I'm getting all these tickets thrown at me, you know, because, well, that was my ninth DUI. And, oh, come on now, that's not that many. Oh, yeah, that was the Al-Anons doing that. That's probably a lot. That's a lot for you, isn't it, Helen? Anyway, that was my ninth DUI, and when you got that many DUIs, you don't have a driver's license, so I got a driver, I'm driving under suspension ticket, and when you don't have a driver's license and you got nine DUIs, you don't have any insurance on your car, so I got no insurance, and man, my tags were expired, and I got a ticket for that, and I always like to run my mouth when I got arrested. I wasn't very bright, and the police would address the problem, and I'd be spitting blood up on the sidewalk. Now I got a littering ticket. and on it went like that. You know, these guys were picking on me, Ellen. And with all of that stuff, when you got that much stuff going on for you, you're on probation. And I got a violation of probation, and I got to go sit in jail with no bond, because you don't get bond when you violate your probation like I did. And, so I was sitting in a cell getting ready to go to the penitentiary when somebody came and said, hey, your name's on the bond board. And I ran over there and took a look at that, and sure enough, there I was for $100. And might as well have been a million for me, but I knew how to get 100. I called my youngest brother. I have two younger brothers. Both alcoholics, and all three of us were thieves long before we were alcoholics. Our parents had been bailing us out of jail for a long time. And they went pretty much broke trying to keep their three kids out of penitentiary. And, well, they kind of ran out of money while John was coming up, and he had to do a little bit of time, and they felt bad for that. They never did find Al-Anon. They felt real bad about that, and they would try to make it up to him, and I called John and said, call Mom, Dad, get $100. I don't care what you tell them, and come get me out of here. He did that, and they had a little bit of extra money, and they sent him $200 because, like I said, they felt bad. And he came and got me, bond me out of jail, gave me the other $100 and said, I'll see you later. I said, hold on there, buddy, where are you going? He said, I'm going home. I said, yeah, take me with you. I need to think. And he said, you can't come to my house. I said, why not? He said, my wife hates you. Well, that's fair enough. I hate your wife. So. I said, take me to Bill's house. That's my other brother. He said, well, I talked to Bill before I came down here. Bill said, you can't come to his house either. I said, why not? Bill said, him and his wife hate you. Now, I didn't tell you guys about my mother's family. My mother's family, she's the youngest of 10 children, and she's the youngest by 7 years. So she's got nieces and nephews older than she is. My mother gave birth to 5 boys. Only 3 of us lived for any great length of time. And the 5 kids my mom had was the least amount of kids those 9 other brothers and sisters had. And like I said, I had cousins older than my parents, so I got 2nd and 3rd cousins older than me. I had probably 1,000 cousins. Close as I can count, about 1,000 cousins. And I wasn't allowed in any of their houses. But like I said, I was a thief before I was a drunk, and I was a bad thief, and I'd get caught. So I figured, early on, I could go rob my cousin Skip, and if he caught me, probably the worst he'd do is beat me up and throw me out of his house, and I wouldn't be allowed back there, which happened quite a bit. But if I went to somebody's house and broke in like Palmer that doesn't know me, well, he might shoot me. And I'm not a brave alcoholic. So there I was. My brothers won't let me in their house. My cousins won't let me in their houses. My parents live in Florida, and I promised I'd never go there. So I took that $100 and went out and got some thinking material, got a bottle of liquor. And before I got done with that bottle of liquor, my keen alcoholic mind went and bought a bus ticket to Florida. And I knew they'd take me in, and they did, just like they always did, took me in. Cleaned me up. My dad, I don't know how he did it, but he got me a job. And I didn't keep it long, and I was not a very good employee. I couldn't keep a job. And I start drinking myself to death. And before I could finish the job, my dad died. And we brought him back to Cincinnati to bury him. My mom wanted her oldest son to help her bury her lover 35 years. And I was too drunk to help. But one of those guys that I drank out in the woods with was sober in AA. And he came and helped my mom bury her husband. And he took me out and he talked to me about his drinking. Not mine. And when he got done, I said, well, you need to go to AA. If I drank as bad as you, that's where I'd go. And I moved back to Florida to finish killing myself and couldn't get the job done there, so I came back to Ohio again. And I was in pretty bad shape. I had been homeless for a long time, really. If I wasn't in jail, I was pretty much homeless. And I didn't have a trade. I didn't have an education. I was illiterate between the whiskey and the 1970s happening. I couldn't read or write. And I'd found an abandoned shack on the Little Miami River. I was living in that. Had a tar paper roof and a dirt floor and a hole in the ground to go to the bathroom in. And I'd get some kind of cheap buck and drink that and pass out. And I'd go into the DTs and it jerked me awake and I'd drink some more. pass out. When I ran out of that cheap vodka, I'd jerk myself up and go to the nearest convenience store and threaten the clerk and steal some more and go back down there. And I didn't have any teeth, and I couldn't have told you last time I'd had a bath, and my hair was long and stringy, and so was my beard. I had a little bit of change that I'd bummed one morning and come off that riverbank and went to this knife and gun club where I liked to drink, where people got shot quite regular. Maybe one of those guys in there would do me the favor, put me out of my misery. And before I got there, I sat down and smoked a cigarette. Saw a phone booth across the street, and a thought crossed my mind. It had to have been planted by God, because I didn't think like that. But the thought went across my mind was, I wonder if Greg's still not drinking. I went over there and called him. And he was still sober. And I said, can you come get me? He said, sure, where are you? And I told him. He went, oh, hell. A bad section of town. He said, wait right there, I'll be there. And he pulled up in a 1973 LTD. I tell you that because I weighed 307 pounds when I got sober. And even with all the food y'all fed me this week, I don't weigh that much. If he'd have come in a Volkswagen, you'd have a different speaker, I tell you. He took a look at his lifelong friend and started to cry, and I thought, oh man, I've done some damage here. And he's crying. He picked me up and he put me in his car, and he took me to his house and he rocked me to sleep. And his wife heard that drunks that go into DTs like me need lots of sugar. So I started getting anything with sugar on it. Orange juice with carob syrup. Candy bars, chewing gum. If it had sugar on it, Edie was putting it in my mouth. She'd be baking cookies, anything, keep me from going into DTs. About 10 years ago, I got diabetes, and I called her up and said, Edie, it's all your fault. So I'm living on Greg's couch. He'd done the ultimate 12-step call. Came and got me, put me on his couch. His kids were on break from school. They were 12 and 10. He had 12 and 10-year-old daughters. And they were overjoyed because they had themselves a puppet, more or less, a mannequin. And they were doing like a lot of young girls were doing, practicing makeup. Well, they put it on me. One time I'd wake up looking like Marilyn Monroe. And a little while later, I'd wake back up and I'd look like Marilyn Manson. Those two girls took pity on me and taught me how to read out of the big book. They were very patient, a lot more patient than some grown-ups probably would have been with someone like me, because I brought the language of the street into their home. They didn't know what I was saying, but they knew it wasn't nice, and they threatened me and said, if you don't stop talking to us like that, we're going to tell our dad and he'll beat you up. And Greg was a pretty big guy, and I was tired. And, so those two girls taught me how to clean my mouth and read. And I love those kids. They're grown women today. They're both in their 30s and have children of their own. And I talk to them every now and again. They're just wonderful girls. And So Greg's working hard, his kids are playing with me, his wife's baking cookies for me. He comes home from work tired, takes a look at me laying on his couch in a lap of luxury, and says, get in the car. I said, where are we going? He said, don't worry about it. I've looked at your date book, there's absolutely nothing in it. Now go get in the car. And he took me to AA. First meeting I was at, a guy stood up and thanked them all for 2 years. I stood up right behind him, called him a liar. So nobody can stay sober that long. I thought Greg was lying. And a couple of days later, he took me to a beginner's meeting, except this was a big church that had two or three different meetings going at the same time. And this is just for you old timers. Don't let go of your newcomers. Don't let them wander off. Because I kind of escaped from Greg and wandered into the middle of a discussion meeting. And partway through that meeting, I stood up to share my experience, strength, and hope with all of you. All 3 days of it. Some old timer stood up and said, "Boy, you need to shut up and sit down." I said, "Old man, you need to go out the window." And I went to throw him out the window, and we were up on the second floor of a large church. And you guys gang-tackled me. I couldn't believe it. All these AA people that were smiling at me and stuff, they jumped on top of me. I was thrashing and kicking and cussing. I would have bit somebody. I didn't have no teeth. And the old man standing back laughing at me going, "Keep coming back, boy. Keep coming back." The one AA slogan I could have done without at the moment, I'll tell you. But I'll tell you what, though. Even, you know, as foggy as I was when Greg brought me to you all, and as crazy as I acted when I got here, I really knew that old man and all of you guys meant that when you said, "Keep coming back." And I could have showed out. I did show out in those bars that I hung out in. And when they told you were through, you were through. You didn't get to keep going back there. And AA said, "Keep coming back." So I did. And Greg started taking me through the steps. You know, slowly, like, "Do you believe you're powerless over alcohol?" And I said, "I don't know." "Well, when you start drinking and take a drink, can you stop?" I said, "Sometimes." He said, "When you take two drinks, can you stop?" And I said, "Sometimes." And he started to get that look, you know, that sponsors get. So I figured I'd better volunteer something. And I said, "If I drink three or four drinks, I can't tell you what state I'm going to wake up in." He said, "That sounds pretty powerless to me." He said, "Do you believe that your life's unmanageable?" And he said, "Hold on, before you get to these I don't knows, you're sleeping on my couch." Then he read me step two and said, "You better hope there's a power out there greater than you that'll restore you to sanity, Chuck Hartley. You're the craziest guy I've ever met in my whole life." Well, that was step two. And we went to step three. He said, "Get on your knees." I said, "Hold on." "Yeah, we've been buddies a long time, Greg." He said, "No, dummy, we're not going to do anything like that. We're going to pray." "Oh, can't we go back to what I was thinking about a second ago?" See, because I wasn't real keen on this God idea. I got drugged to church when I was a kid. And the preacher preached, and the deacons did whatever deacons do. And then I start drinking and sneaking out at night. And I'm hanging around in the CD bars, and back behind the bars, hoping we can get some older drunk to buy us some cheap wine or something. And where I've seen most of the deacons of my church, too. So I figured if they was back there drinking and doing what they was doing with women I knew weren't their wives, there's no need for me to go to church. And if God had called those men, then I didn't need him. Besides, if he'd had any sort of concern for the way my life was going, he'd kind of forgot about me as far as I was concerned. Either that or he just didn't like me. So I had no use for it. And now this guy's telling me we're going to pray. And he said, "Okay, do you believe that I believe?" And I went, "Yeah, I've been watching you. You're a nut for God, you know. Every time they open the daggone church, you're over there. You're volunteering, singing in the choir, and doing a Bible study. You're a nut for God." He said, "Good. Then you just borrow my God." And I tell you what, for years, my prayer started, "Dear Greg's God." Now, somewhere along the line, I had enough willingness to invite God into my life. And I've got a really big God today that can do anything at all. So if you're struggling out there with a God thing, just use mine. And because dear Chuck's God seems a lot less threatening, I think, sometimes than to get down and on our knees and just pray to God. And he took me through these steps about as quick as I'm telling them here. You know, I didn't get any rest period. If I'd known I could have asked for a break, I would have. And, you know, I did as good a four-step as I could. And people helped me write it. I brought it to him. He looked at it, put it aside, and said, "I know about most of this stuff. I was with you." He said, "Tell me the three things you weren't going to tell me." You know, that's exactly how many things I wasn't going to tell him. Three. And I told him about it, and I was set free. My life in Alcoholics Anonymous was just growing. My mother moved back to Ohio to be near her family. She and I took an apartment together. It's the first time I'd ever been self-supporting through my own contributions. Actually paid my share of the rent, my share of the food, my share of the light bill. And we got to know each other, my mother and I. And you guys had your way with me. And my mother and I were sitting around talking one day, and she got up to go to the bathroom, and I thought, you know, these AA folks keep talking about practicing good manners. Maybe I should go over and fill Mom's coffee cup up. So I went over to get my mother's coffee cup. And there in her chair was her wallet. Now, I hadn't seen my mom's wallet since I was about 6 years old. And I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to have some fun with my mother when she comes back and tease her about getting old and forgetful. So she comes back. I start teasing her about the mind being the first thing to go as you get older. She didn't know what I was talking about. Finally, I let her in on my little secret and said, "Mom, you left your wallet in your chair." I said, "You've never done that." She said, "Well, Chuck, that's because I trust you." Now, I've had a lot of neat things happen to me in sobriety, but just that one little thing right there, I'd still be here tonight. Getting back the trust of my mother that I hadn't had since I was a little kid. All because of you guys. All because there is a God out there that's merciful. And I started doing AA a lot. Greg took me every day, so I went every day. I was probably 2.5 years sober before I missed a meeting. I didn't know I could miss. I figured it out. Now I'm going to go to 5. My mother lived in a housecoat all of her life. She one that she made, you know, all up and down the inside of both sides of her housecoat were pockets. And anything my mom thought was valuable went in the robe. Her wallet was in the robe, her credit cards were in the robe, pictures were in the robe, marriage license in the robe, real jewelry in the robe, fake jewelry in the robe. My mom thought it was valuable it went in the robe because she had 3 thieving sons, and that's where she put her valuables. And I got to whining to my mother one day about being so stupid, not even a GED. And she said, "You got GED, honey." And she went in a robe, pulled out this GED, had my name on it. Now, as I've talked about a lot tonight, the keen alcoholic mind, it took me till I was about 18 years sober to figure out When I went into the Army, my youngest brother was 13 years old. But he was a pretty mature 13-year-old. He shaved every day and had hair on his chest. And I didn't want him to struggle with a fake ID like I had, so I gave him mine. And he went off to take the GED test one day, and the only ID he had said Chuck Hartley on it. So he gave it to my mother, and she put it in the rug. So I'm a genius now, high school graduate, and I was hanging out with young people in AA because adults scared me. I was 32 going on 12, and I hung out with a lot of the teenagers in AA, and they were going to college, and I started whining to one of them, Jeff, and I wish I could go to school like you, Jeff. And he said, why don't you? You know, much like Palmer talked about last night, I said, Jeff, you know how old I'll be in 4 years if I go to college? And he said, no, fool, how old are you going to be in four if you don't? Well, I just got that GED. So I did the math. I went and talked to the vocational rehabilitation people, and they said, oh, yeah, we love to work with drunks like you. You make our successes look really good. And they said, well, we'll send you to college, Chuck, but the tests show that you'd make a good social worker. I said, a social worker? Have you lost your mind? I said, I hate people. I lived in the woods. Come on. And she said, I don't care. The test said you make a good social worker. I said, lady, I'm sitting in your office. I have two pistols and a knife. I hate people. God bless her. She stood her ground. I'd still have a GED. She said, I don't care what you got on you. The test said you make a good social worker. You don't want to go to school to be a social worker? Get out of my office. So off I went to the school to be a social worker. 4 years later, I had an undergraduate degree. And the dean of the college is going around and shaking everybody's hand. And, you know, congratulations, you're going to go to grad school? No, oh, that's too bad. Congratulations, you're going to go to grad school? Yes, I am. Good, good, you'll be a fine student. And he gets to me and he goes, Chucker, tell me you're going to go to grad school. You know, your story just kind of comes out when you're a social work major, and those folks, much like Dwight, they adopted me, and they really did help me a lot. Those young kids going to college, and the dean knew about it, and he was excited, and he, please tell me you're going to go to grad school. I said, I can't go, Dean. I don't have any money. I've gotten married. Well, I've been going to school here, and have two children, and I just probably need to get a job, and I just can't afford grad school right now. And he said, Chuck, can you afford to go to grad school if I pay for it? Now, I got to tell you guys, I'm a child of the 70s. My drug of choice is free, followed closely by more. And this guy was offering me free and more on a silver platter. I went and talked to my wife, whose drug of choice is also free and more. And we decided maybe we could swing grad school. And 2 years later, there I stood with the hood on, going to get a graduate degree in administrative social work. So, you know, only in Alcoholics Anonymous do you get to go from homeless, illiterate, to graduate degree in 10 short years. You can only do that here. Only the power of a loving God enables you to do the kind of things that are necessary to go to school full-time and work and participate in an equal marriage and help raise two children and still go to 4 or 5 AA meetings a week. I don't know where that, I don't know how to make that kind of time. I really don't. I have no idea how to do that. But God does and did and blessed me abundantly. I told you guys that I learned how to date in Lonnie's Lounge. Wasn't much, but it worked for me. And, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to date someone, but I didn't know how. So I went to the old timers and said, how do you date? And they said, well, Chuck, most of us learn how to do that when we're teenagers. But we know you're a special case, so here's what we suggest you do. First, it helps to have a willing participant. I said, I already got my eye on somebody. They're like, good. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to arrange to take her out to coffee and a meeting. And you're going to pick her up at her house. You're going to walk her out to the car. You're going to open the car door. You're going to let her get in the car. Let her get all the way in the car, Chuck. I need a lot of help. Close the door. Go on your date. Talk to her a little bit about yourself. Don't tell her everything, Chuck. You don't want to scare her. Bring her home. Walk her to her apartment. Thank her for a nice evening. And then I inserted my part and said, I know what to do from here. I'm going to go inside and get lucky, right? And they're like, no, Chuck. You're going to thank her for a nice evening. Then you're going to turn around and leave. I thought that was the stupidest advice I'd ever gotten in my whole life. But I was very willing when I got here because I didn't know how to do anything. And you guys taught me how to do everything, from shining my shoes to tying my tie to asking a woman on a date. And I did that, and we had a good time. I guess we had a good time because we had another date. And we started to date and found that we liked each other's company. So we dated some more and fell in love. And I asked her to marry me, and she said that she would. And I've been married to my best friend for 19 years, all because of you guys. We dated with our clothes on. It was suggested to us by our sponsors. Well, my sponsor said, pretty sure Beth has had sex before. She's got 2 kids. And we'll just take your word for it, Chuck. It's a good way to get to know someone, not having to struggle with sex, because her sponsor told her the same thing, more or less. And it took some of the pressure off and allowed us to fall in love the way that we fell in love. And, it's worked for us. And Beth brought the 2 kids into the marriage. They were 10 and 8. And I didn't know anything about children. I'd never fathered any children. My brothers wouldn't let me near theirs. So I kind of learned on the job, you know. And Beth had a beautiful blue-eyed, blonde-haired daughter who I fell in love with instantly. And like she said, we had so much fun with her being the grown-up in our home. And she always wanted a dad and couldn't wait to call me dad, and still calls me dad today, and has blessed us with a granddaughter who calls me G-Pa. And I get to hang out with her anytime I want to. And it's only a result of being sober here with you guys. Our son did not want a father. Made it very clear to me that he did not want a father. We both tried, but it became pretty clear that we were in a battle for man of the house, and he wasn't going to win, and he didn't like that. And we had some troubles along the way with that. And Eventually, Beth and I had to send him to wilderness school because of the way that he was acting, not only towards me, but towards the world in general. And he went over there, and they saved his life. It really did. And he tried to commit suicide 3 times in 1 day. And probably would have succeeded had not been for some poor planning on his part. And he grew up and joined the Army. Came home from the Army a changed man. And some of it was for the better and some of it wasn't. But he came to me and asked if I could help him, and I did. And he moved, he bought a house about 3 miles away from me and Beth. And he comes to our home on a regular basis. He's got a key to our house. This week he's got the keys to my truck. Pray for me. He's 29 years old and he's a fine man. I heard one of the speakers talk about needing to make amends to their father. They wrote a letter and went to the gravesite and said the prayer. I believe it was Palmer. And I did the same thing. My dad died 2 years before I got sober. And for some reason, that didn't take for me. I always had this nagging guilt and remorse that concerned my father. He was such a wonderful man. And I treated him very poorly. And I heard Keith Lewis speak one night. He talked about making amends to someone that was deceased. And I went and got with him after he spoke, and he said, "Chuck, go and find yourself someone that reminds you of your father." He said, "They don't have to look like him, but just someone that kind of reminds you of him. If it's someone in AA and you ask them to fill in for you so you can make that amends face to face, they'll do it." And the taper at that conference was a guy that was kind of a nerd like my dad. He wore a tie and a coat to work, even though he didn't have to. My dad did the same thing. He didn't have to, but he did. And had a pocket protector full of pens, and so did my dad. And he wore glasses, and he'd loosen his tie up maybe a little bit when he was working off the clock, and that was about it. But when you went to my father and you said, "Dad, I need to talk to you about something," my dad made you the most important person in that room. He'd push his glasses up on his nose, and he'd tighten his tie up, and he'd look you in the eye, and he'd say, "How can I help you, son?" And I went to that taper. His name's Dick Martin. He's my sponsor today. And I told him what I wanted to do. And he pushed his glasses up on his nose, and he tightened his tie. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "What can I help you with, son?" I was able to make things right with my father. And I don't have any remorse, any guilt, or any bad feelings at all today. I was able to make face-to-face amends just by being present in my own recovery and listening to someone else share their experience, strength, and hope. Became clear to me that I needed a sponsor. And not long after that, Dick said he'd be my sponsor. He's been my sponsor for 14 years. He's my hero. I don't want anything more than to be like him, a citizen. I think that's all that any of us really strive to be once we get sober and set on the right course. We want to become citizens again. We want to vote when we're supposed to vote. We want to be present in our community. We want to pay our taxes. We want to raise our children. We want to support them in their endeavors. I've been able to do that through following his example and listening to you people. I didn't have a driver's license when I got sober. And that ninth DUI, I had ran away from for a long time. When I was about a year sober, my sponsor said, "If you don't make that amends, you're going to drink." And I didn't want to make it, but I didn't want to drink again either. So I went and turned myself into the police. Apparently there'd been some drunken brawl downtown and jail cells were full up. They said, "We think anybody that turned herself in after this many years will come back to court tomorrow. So here's your courtroom you'll go to, and here's the judge you'll be in front of." I knew I was going to go to the penitentiary. It was a judge that sentenced me on 5 or 6 other DUIs. And I always went to court and in going to jail shape, so I was pretty well toasted when I'd go to court. And one time I overshot the mark and called him out of his name. So I had a history with that judge. It wasn't a good one. But I stood in front of him and he said, "Tell me what's been going on, where you've been all this time." And I told him exactly how you folks had had your way with me. And he said, "You know what? I've been trying to produce some effect like that in you for many years." He said, "I tried a lot of alternative sentencing with you and none of it ever took." He said, "So whatever you're doing in AA, keep doing it. Now, as to the DUI, you're guilty." I knew I was guilty. And then he started talking like judges like to talk. And he said, "You know, I have every right to send you to the penitentiary." I said, "Yes, sir, I know that." And he said, "The citizens of Hamilton County almost demand that I send you to the penitentiary." And I'm thinking, yeah, get with it. You know, I'm ready to go. And he said, "I'm not going to send you to the penitentiary." And when I picked my jaw back up off the ground, I timidly asked, "Why not?" And he said, "I'd be sending the wrong man." He said, "Those people in AA have had their way with you, and it shows. And I don't want to do anything to disrupt that." And he said, "Now I've got a job to do, so I'm going to put you on probation." And then he reminded me of another amends that I needed to make. He said, "I'm going to put you on probation until you pay off the insurance company to the damages for the Mercedes." And he said, "But the day you pay that off, you come see me and I'll take you off of probation." And I did just that. It took a year or two. And when I stood in front of him, he became one of my strongest supporters that I could get my driver's license back in the state of Ohio. So I got a driver's license in my pocket today, got my name on it. I don't owe anybody anything past. Raised 2 kids to adulthood, you got a lot of current stuff. But I don't owe any past. And I'm having a great time doing this deal. Participating in my recovery, being in love with a beautiful woman that I get to travel and do things with, coming to conferences like this and hanging out with all of my new friends. And you're just not supposed to get here from where I was. You're really not. So, conference slogan says, a spiritual life is not a theory. Thanks for my life.